Good to be with you again on this beautiful Lord's Day. Please turn in your Bibles to Exodus chapter 23. We'll be reading there in just a moment. Exodus chapter 23. If you're visiting with us, thanks again for being here. We appreciate your presence, and we ask you to come back anytime that you have the opportunity. I preached a lesson in the early part of January. I think it was the first week in January, about the Feast of Weeks, better known as the Feast of Pentecost, and the spiritual significance that is tied with that feast. We looked at some of the physical things that went along with the Feast of Weeks, and then we just asked, is there any connection? Is there any connection to why the important events on Pentecost happened in Acts chapter 2 on that holiday, on that festival? What we saw was that it was the first fruits of wheat in the Old Testament, physical wheat. They brought in the first fruits of that crop. And then we saw in the New Testament that souls are compared to wheat. We didn't use this particular passage, but it was used by Chris in an invitation not too long ago in John chapter 4, where Jesus says the fields are white for harvest. Well, it's wheat that gets that white head on it. But Jesus wasn't talking about wheat, he was talking about souls. Souls were ready to be harvested. But the comparison is there. Souls are spiritual wheat. But the passage that we did use was in Luke chapter 3 and in Matthew chapter 3, where John the Baptizer is talking about Jesus, the one who would come after him, and how the winnowing fork was in his hand, and how he would separate chaff from wheat. The chaff would go to unquenchable fire. The wheat would be gathered into his barn, harvested, and brought into his church, the kingdom that is Christ's. Well, somebody after that sermon asked me, as we were talking about studying the shadows of the Old Testament, he said, we know about the significance of the Feast of Unleavened Bread and the Feast of Weeks, but what about the Feast of Tabernacles? The Feast of Tabernacles. Do we know what that spiritual significance is? Do we know what that reality is to that shadow in the old? And I really didn't have a clue at the time. And so we talked about it for a moment, and then I went home and studied for a while about this feast, this festival, one of the three pilgrimage festivals in the Old Testament. And is there a spiritual reality to this feast? I certainly think so. I think that the Feast of Tabernacles has its reality in the Day of Judgment. But before we talk about that, let's look at some Old Testament and just realize what it is, because it might not be readily on our minds. Let's talk about the names of this particular feast. Here in Exodus chapter 23, we're given the Feast of Ingathering. We often refer to it as the Feast of Booths or Tabernacles, but it is also called by this name, Feast of Ingathering, in verse 16. You shall keep the Feast of Harvest, the first fruits of your labor, of what you sow in your field. And now note, you shall keep the Feast of Ingathering at the end of the year when you gather in from the field the fruit of your labor. So, not rocket science. We know why it's called the Feast of Ingathering. They were gathering in the laborers and gathering in the labor. Okay, so we understand the significance of that name. But the Feast of Booths, or the Feast of Tabernacles, do we understand why it's called by that name? Turn with me to Leviticus chapter 23. Leviticus chapter 23. And here we're told about this particular name, the Feast of Booths, or Tabernacles, depending on your translation. Look at verse 33 of chapter 23. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel, saying, on the 15th day of the seventh month, for 7 days, is the Feast of Booths. You may have a note in your margin or on the bottom of your page, Tabernacles, to the Lord. Verse 35, on the first day shall be a holy convocation. You shall not do any ordinary work. This word comes from a word called sukkah, which just means a hut woven by different branches and leaves. We're going to see a passage in just a moment from Nehemiah about which branches they used, but it's just a little hut. Well, why would they call a feast after a hut? Well, glad you asked. Verse 42 and verse 43. You shall dwell in booths or tabernacles for 7 days. All the native Israelites shall dwell in booths. And here's why. Verse 43. that your generations may know that I made the people of Israel dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So they were to remember this idea that the Israelites, when they came out of Egypt and they were marching to the land of Canaan, the promised land, they were staying in tabernacles. So once a year, in the seventh month, their seventh month, they came to Jerusalem, everybody came to Jerusalem, and they were to literally stay in a tabernacle, a tent, we might call it. Go to Nehemiah chapter 8, and we'll learn about what this hut was made out of. Nehemiah chapter 8. We'll also learn that the people of Israel didn't keep this feast very well. This text will tell us that when they celebrated it for the first time after coming back from captivity, they had not celebrated it since the days of Joshua, who brought them into the land of Canaan first. Here we are in verse 13. On the second day, the heads of the fathers' houses of all the people with the priests and the Levites came together to Ezra the scribe in order to study the words of the law. So they're coming together for a Bible study. Ezra is the Bible class teacher, so to speak. Verse 14, and they found it written in the law that the Lord had commanded by Moses that the people of Israel should dwell in booths during the feast of the seventh month, and that they should proclaim it and publish it in all their towns and in Jerusalem. Go out to the hills and bring in branches of olive. Here's what these huts were made out of. These weren't temporary dwellings like Motel 6 or the Hyatt. They were literally huts from branches. Bring in the branches of olive, wild olive, myrtle, palm, and other leafy trees to make booths, as it is written. So the people went out and brought them and made booths for themselves, each on his own roof, and in their courts, and in the courts of the house of God, and in the square of the water gate, and in the square at the gate of Ephraim. And all the assembly of those who had returned from the captivity made booths and lived in booths. For from the days of Joshua, the son of Nun, to that day, the people of Israel had not done so. And there was very great rejoicing. Now verse 18. Day by day, from the first day to the last, he read the book of the law of God. They kept the feast 7 days. And on the eighth day, there was a solemn assembly according to the rule. So they finally got together after the captivity. They found it in the book as they were studying with Ezra. They said, this is what God wants. And they literally made huts and lived in huts for 7 days. Well, is there a spiritual reality to this festival? As I mentioned at the very beginning, I think it's Judgment Day. And the two reasons that I believe that all have to do with the names. As we transition to the New Testament, keep those names in the back of your mind. The Feast of Ingathering, the gathering in of labors and laborers, and then the Feast of Booths. Here we go. Go to Matthew chapter 20. And let's read a parable about the gathering in of God's laborers. Matthew chapter 20. There are several different parables that are Judgment Day parables, but the reason why I'm choosing this one is because it uses the word laborers. And the idea of gathering them in and their labor is here in this parable. Begin reading with me in verse 1 of Matthew chapter 20. For the kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. Now, I want to stop here and make a point about the Lord's church. Has it ever sunk in that we are called laborers? This church thing, brethren, is work. We are called together to work. We're not sitting on our hands. We shouldn't be. We have a lot of people in this congregation with great work ethics, climbing ladders of corporations and businesses. And I wonder if that work ethic transitions into the church. I wonder if we had a boss, if we just get canned. This is work. We're called together to work. Don't miss that. Verse 2. After agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And going out about the third hour, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace, and he said to them, you go into the vineyard too, and whatever is right I will give you. So they went out.
Going again, about the sixth hour and the ninth hour, he did the same. So the master of the house, he goes out to this marketplace and he calls together some laborers about 6 a.m. and he agrees with them for a denarius, a day's wage. Well, then he hires some more about 9 a.m. and then 12 and then 3 p.m. But there's no agreement on wage. Did you notice that? All that's said is, whatever's right, that's what I'll give you. Hang on to that point. Well, then he goes out about 5 p.m. Look at verse 6. About the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing. He said to them, "Why do you stand here idle all day?" Verse 7. They said to him, "Because no one has hired us." He said to them, "You go into the vineyard too." And when the evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, "Call the laborers and pay them their wages." Can I just paraphrase? Gather in the laborers. In gathering, have an in gathering of laborers. Verse 8, call the laborers, pay them their wages, beginning with the last up to the first. And when those who had been hired at the 11th hour came, each of them received a denarius. Now when those hired first came, they thought they would receive more, but each of them also received a denarius. So the people who were hired at 6 a.m., they're in the back of this line, right? This payment line. The people who were hired at the 11th hour, they see that they get a denarius. And the people in the back of the line are thinking, all right, minimum wage just went up. We agreed for a denarius, but these one-hour workers are getting paid the same, so we've got to be getting paid more, right? But when they get to the front of the line, they get the denarius, what they agreed for. Verse 11. So what happens? They do what any laborer in America would do. They get the union lawyer and file a labor grievance. Verse 11. And on receiving it, they grumbled at the master of the house, saying, "These last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat." But he replied to them, "Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last worker as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or do you begrudge my generosity? So the last will be first, and the first last." Now, before I say anything about the Feast of Ingathering, I do want to say a lot of people have a problem with this parable being a judgment parable. And I've been in that group before. I remember about 4 years ago, Dale and I standing after a Wednesday night Bible study and talking about this particular parable. And the beef that a lot of people have about this parable being a judgment parable is the fact that people are grumbling. Are people really going to grumble, complain about who's going to heaven? Are people really going to grumble come judgment day about people receiving a reward? I just can't imagine that. But as Dale told me, and I knew this already, but from time to time you look at a parable and you don't apply it this way. Not every detail in every parable has an explicit application. Listen to that again. Not every detail in every parable has an explicit application. It's just an analogy. That's all it is. And perhaps the parable that proves this point the best is the parable of the 10 virgins. You remember that one? Where 5 are ready and 5 are not ready for the coming of Jesus Christ, and they're awaiting Jesus Christ, and the 5 that are not ready, they begin to panic, and then they go into the marketplace and they miss the coming of Jesus Christ. Are people going to miss it? Are people going to miss out? No. Every eye will see, every tongue confess, every knee will bow. There's none going to be MIA come judgment day. People aren't going to miss out on it. People aren't going to miss the coming of the bridegroom. So not every aspect of every parable, but getting back to the parable, what's the true point of the parable? That's what we're after. That our payment, that our reward, brethren, is not based on labor necessarily as much as it is the master's generosity. It's not about how long we've been in the Lord's church, or how perfect we've done things, but about His mercy, His generosity. And if that bothers you, do you begrudge the Master's generosity? Let's take Bob Dill and Raul Rodriguez for an example. I think Bob Dill has been a Christian longer than anyone in this congregation, about 80 years. He's in his 90s, early 90s, and I know he obeyed the gospel as a young man. Raul Rodriguez obeyed the gospel not even 2 months ago. If Jesus comes back tonight and they both receive heaven, we would learn the point of this parable, right? And as a young person, as a younger Christian and a younger preacher, I can't tell you how much confidence that instills in me, because I really haven't done a lot. But you know what matters? I'm in the vineyard. I'm in the church that belongs to Jesus Christ. That's what matters. Now, do we play a part in our salvation? Going back to this morning's lesson, absolutely. You got to be a laborer. You got to sign up to be in his vineyard and be added to his church. But the point is, when is this going to happen? Getting back to the Feast of Ingathering, when is that going to happen? When are all laborers and all labor gathered in? The end times. Go with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 3. And look at this passage, 1 Corinthians chapter 3. When will our work be tested, our labor be put to the test? Here we are in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, beginning in verse 10. It says, according to the grace of God given to me, like a skilled master builder, I laid a foundation. Someone else is building upon it. Let each one take care how he builds upon it. For no one can lay a foundation other than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now, if anyone builds on that foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each one's work will become manifest. When will that labor be tested and manifested? Listen to this, verse 13. For the day, my Bible capitalizes that word day, and I know that there was no capitalization in the original Greek, but I think the translators have it right here, because the day will disclose it, because it will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test what sort of work each one has done. When will the labor be tested with fire? It's like all your labor. And I know that this text has more to do with teaching, preaching, than it does our lives. But just imagine this. All your labor is put on a pallet, and you strike a match, throw it on the pallet. What gets burned up? Everything secular. Cars, our secular jobs, our homes, our clothes. Everything in this world will be burned up. But what will stay is what's built on the foundation that is Jesus Christ. But when is this day of fire? 2 Peter chapter 3 says the day of fire will be the last day, when the labor gets brought in and tested. Go with me to Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews chapter 4. And this passage has more to do with the rest after labor is over. What the Hebrew writer is doing here in Hebrews chapter 4 is talking about the Sabbath rest, the spiritual, eternal Sabbath rest that is heaven. And what the Hebrew writer does in chapter 3 is he talks about God swearing, not curse word swearing, but oath taking, and how God had taken an oath. He swore in his wrath that certain Israelites would not enter a Sabbath rest, his Sabbath rest. That swearing is verse 11 of chapter 3. As I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Now, what the Hebrew writer goes on to make the point is this, that the rest God is swearing about, that the Israelites would not enter, he's not talking about Canaan. He's not talking about the land of Judea, the land of promise, the physical land. What God was swearing about is they shall not enter my spiritual, eternal rest. And we know that because of chapter 4, verse 8. Look at verse 8 of chapter 4. For if Joshua had given them rest, Joshua was the one that brought them into the land of Canaan, right? If Joshua had actually given them rest, God would not have spoken of another day later on. So there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. When God swore in chapter 3, verse 11, I know that's a quotation from the Old Testament, but when God swore that, God wasn't talking about the land of Canaan. God's talking about the eternal spiritual rest that is ours. Verse 10, chapter 4. For whoever has entered God's rest has also rested from his works as God did from his. When that rest comes, the Hebrew writer says you will rest just as much as God did on the seventh day. When God created in 6 days, how done was he? He was done, right? And when will be the day when we are done? Now you might say death, and that would be true, but there's still laborers back in the vineyard. When will they all be gathered in and all laborers are done? That great day. But I don't even think that this is the greatest evidence that the day of judgment is the spiritual fulfillment of the Feast of Tabernacles. What I think is the greatest evidence is this: that we are in the time of booths right now. Our booth dwelling being our bodies. The New Testament, on several occasions, and we'll just go to two, references our body as a tabernacle or a tent. Go with me to John chapter 1, the Gospel of John chapter 1. And you may have touched on this in the adult Bible class. I wasn't in the adult Bible class at that time, because we just studied this. This may be fresh on your memory. But look at verse 14 of John chapter 1. We're told that the Word was God and that He created everything. And then we're told who the Word is in verse 14. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Underline that word dwelt in your mind. Dwelt among us. We have seen His glory. Glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. Now, the term dwelt, it's not a fancy term in the English. But guess what that is in the Greek? Skinu, which is literally translated tented, tabernacled, boothed, hutted. What Jesus did is came down in the flesh and He tabernacled. This is the time of tabernacles. We don't live in eternal dwellings. We don't live in anything permanent. And the idea of the Feast of Tabernacles is looking back at that time, past tense. When will be the time where we look past tense at our time in tabernacles? When we receive the new body, right? Go to 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and see this connection. This is powerful stuff. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 1. This is the same exact Greek term that is used of John 1:14. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, beginning in verse 1, we know that if our tent, that's the noun form of the verb that was in John 1:14. We know that if our tent, that is our earthly home, is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. This is the time of booths. These branches, this hut. Take up a songbook. We're not done with the sermon. I know I tell you to take up a songbook at the end of the sermon. But take up a songbook and look it with me at 576. I asked Trevor to lead a couple of these songs. Thank you, Trevor, for doing that. I want you to see that this language is in these songs. 576, faith is the victory. Look at the first words of verse 1. What does it say? Encamped. What do people camp in normally? Tents, right? Encamped. How are we encamped? In this tabernacle. Look at verse 3, second stanza, verse 3. Let tents of ease be left behind. Go to song number 480, Dare to Stand Like Joshua. 480, please. Verse 1, stanza 1, first stanza. We are bound for Canaan land, doing what? Tenting, by the way. We sing about this, and the Scripture mentions it in passages like John chapter 1, how Jesus tabernacled, and we're in a tent. But you know what's so sad? we focus sometimes more on this tent than we do our eternal dwelling. When the day of fire comes and all that labor is tested, I got a feeling, myself included, we're going to feel foolish for how much time we spent focusing on the tent. If you're still in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, look at verses 2 through 4. For in this tent we groan, longing to put on our heavenly dwelling, if indeed by putting it on we may not be found naked. Verse 4. For while we are still in this tent, we groan, being burdened. He says in verse 2, we groan. Then in verse 4, he says we groan and are burdened. You know, when I read that, I often think about my body and how blessed I've been to be as healthy as I am. For the most part, I'm as healthy as a horse. I get my colds and battle allergies, but I'm as healthy as a horse. I eat like one too. Why are you laughing? But if you struggle thinking about this body being burdened and groaning, all you got to do is look around at this congregation. Pick up a phone, get in your vehicle, talk to Timothy Barge, talk to the Wilkersons, the Dills. Talk to them. Talk to Joy. Talk to Barbara Gatlin, who's battled cancer. Talk to people. You'll find out there's a lot of groaning and burdens in this tent. And even if you are as healthy as a horse, you are closer to dying now than you've ever been. This tent is going away. And I hope that we, like Paul, are looking forward to putting on the eternal dwelling, our new body, which will be in the likeness of Jesus Christ. You can't ignore death. You know that death is inexplicable by scientists? They can't figure it out. They can tell you that bodies die, and they can tell you maybe how often the cells repeat itself or replicate themselves. But if you asked a scientist why we die, they couldn't figure it out. It's inexplicable. But Jesus of Nazareth showed up about 2,000 years ago, and he assured us that he was going to beat it, not only for himself, but for everyone who believes in him. For if you believe in Jesus and die, you will live again. And those who live and believe in me will never die. And as proof, he walked out of his grave alive. Obey him tonight. Please get out your songbooks and turn to the song of invitation. You have the opportunity to put on Jesus Christ in baptism and be resurrected from that watery grave, clean as a whistle. As we talked about this morning, God will do the work. He will do the operation. Trust him. Will you come as together we stand and sing?